Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got a little Taylor Swift news. We're checking in on the Royals. We've got some news from Hollywood, and we're going to check in on politics as well. We're going to start with Taylor Swift, nothing but net. Worth, that is. Taylor Swift is already a billionaire, but she's also a special other kind of billionaire. This is by Casey Wickman, published on April 2nd. At this point, Taylor Swift has pretty much made a hobby out of smashing records. Most Album of the Year Grammy wins in history? She did that. Youngest artist to write and perform a number one song on the Hot Country Song charts? Hello to 17-year-old Swift, strumming along to Our Song. First artist to occupy all 10 top slots on the Billboard Hot 100 chart at the same time? Meet us at Midnights. The list goes on. Now, according to the Forbes World Celebrity Billionaires 2024 list, she can add another item to her already impressive array of fun facts. Swift is the first person to qualify for billionaire status based solely off of earnings related to her songwriting and performances. She hit the monetary milestone back in October 2023, thanks to the massive success of her Eras tour. But her $1.1 billion estimated net worth can only have grown since then. After all, the analysis in October was before the on-demand home release of her concert film, Taylor Swift, The Eras Tour, and only a nose into its wildly successful theatrical run, a deal that Swift's business arm brokered independently with theaters instead of through a distributor, leading to vaster profits for Swift. That's not even to mention the reported $75 million Disney later paid for the film's streaming rights. And then there's the Eras Tour itself, which is currently on a brief hiatus of its global leg, having already looped South America, Australia, and Asia. The European portion of the tour resumes in May, as will the proceeds from ticket sales, merch, and more. But wait, there's more. In just over 2 weeks, on April 19th, Swift's newest album, The Tortured Poets Department, hits shelves. Swift's online store has already posted several limited edition variants of the album for pre-order. Ask Billie Eilish how she feels about that, and it feels not unlikely that fans will be interested in scooping up Swift's latest. Swift isn't the only billionaire artist on Forbes' list. Fellow artist Rihanna has a reported $1.4 billion net worth, but she's distinguished by earning her slot through her music, not a product line like Rihanna's Fenty makeup line or Savage clothing spinoff and others. And a little other Taylor news. Taylor Swift's mom almost vetoed her signature red lipstick. This is by Casey Wickman, published on April 4th. You know Taylor Swift's red lip classic thing that you like? Her signature red lipstick was almost a no-go owing to qualms voiced by her mother, according to celebrity makeup artist Gucci Westman. In an appearance on the Today with Hoda and Jenna on Tuesday, the stylist revealed that she introduced Swift to her trademark lip color while doing her makeup for the then 19-year-old for the April 2009 cover of Allure. Not only that, but the bold shade that now has become standard for Swift was nearly vetoed by Andrea Swift. I remember I really wanted to do a red lip on her because I hadn't seen her in a red lip before, Westman told Today hosts Coda Cotby and Jenna Bush Hager of The Shoot. And her mom, if I'm allowed to say this, was like, well, Taylor doesn't wear red. And I was like, please, can I just try? Look at her now. Westman, who started her makeup line, Westman Atelier, in 2018, helped Gwyneth Paltrow create her makeup look and get ready for her wedding to Brad Falchuk, and made up Anne Hathaway for her latest Vanity Fair cover shoot, among many other celebrity and editorial bona fides. She demonstrated how quick the application of red lipstick can be with an on-air demo, saying that it can be applied straight from the lipstick tube with a brush or even blotted on with your finger. You can kind of make it cool and it doesn't have to be so fussy, she said of the shade. From watching the Super Bowl to making Grammy's history, the star's seemingly unsmudgeable red lipstick has been there, stalwart since that nudge from Westman a decade and a half ago. Back in 2014, Swift even told People, I never really get too far from red lipstick, do I? I guess I just think my face looks worse without it. That's pretty much the only rationale behind it. In this one case, with apologies to Andrea, it would seem that Mama doesn't always know best. We're checking in on the royals now. King Charles to open parts of Queen Elizabeth's beloved Balmoral Castle, Buckingham Palace, to the public. This is by Casey Wickman, published on April 4th. This summer, royal enthusiasts will be able to set foot inside rooms of two iconic royal residences for the first time ever. The royal family will make internal tours of Scotland's Balmoral Castle, as well as the east wing of Buckingham Palace, available to the public in July and August. Balmoral Castle in Aberdeenshire, Scotland, was known to be the late Queen Elizabeth II's favorite place to spend time. It's also where she spent her final days and died in 2022. Beginning this summer, the public will be allowed to explore parts of the royal residence for the first time ever since its completion in 1855. The royal family usually spends large parts of their summer at Balmoral, a tradition that has continued into the reign of King Charles III. Last summer, the bulk of the royal family, with the exception of the estranged Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle, gathered at the castle. This week, royal websites were updated with tickets for guided tours of the castle, which had previously only been offered on select dates for the grounds and the ballroom. The intimate tours, which were limited to 10 attendees per group and were only available on dates in July and early August, quickly sold out. The royal estate in the Scottish Highlands is a touchstone for the family and the site not only of the family gatherings and the longest-sitting monarch's death, but other milestone memories as well. In a recently resurfaced clip of Prince William giving a speech in Scotland in 2021, he recalled being at Balmoral when he found out that his mother, Princess Diana, had died. "Still in shock, I found sanctuary in the service at Craythy Kirk that very morning," he said, "and in the dark days of grief that followed, I found comfort and solace in the Scottish outdoors. As a result, the connection I feel to Scotland will forever run deep." The castle and its land were first purchased by Queen Victoria and Prince Albert in 1852, when they promptly began construction to expand and modernize the previously too small estate they had fallen in love with. Notably, Queen Elizabeth herself was proposed to by Prince Philip on the 50,000 acres of what Victoria once called "my dear paradise in the Highlands." The rooms of Balmoral aren't the only royal spaces to be made newly available to guests. On Wednesday, the Royal Trust announced that Buckingham Palace's East Wing would also be opened for the first time this summer, following its five-year renovation. This will be the first time that the public will be able to visit the room leading out to the central balcony that has been the setting for so many milestones for the royal family, including the traditional appearance greeting the public at the Summer Trooping the Colour festivities. Certain rooms of Buckingham Palace have been opened in the summer for guided tours since 1992, when Queen Elizabeth began the offering as a fundraiser following a fire in the royal residence. But this is the first time in the castle's history that these rooms will be available for public viewing. In other royal news, Prince Andrew emerges on horseback as movie dramatizing his fall from grace premieres. The embattled royal was seen at Windsor on Friday. This is by Casey Wickman, published on April 5th. Thanks to a newly released movie on Netflix depicting the disastrous series of decisions that led to Prince Andrew's resignation as a senior working royal, the world's attention is once again on King Charles III's younger brother. The embattled royal was spotted out on Friday, the same day that the movie Scoop, which dramatizes the 2019 BBC Newsnight interview in which Andrew defended his ties to convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, hit the streaming service. Andrew, the 64-year-old Duke of York and the eighth in line for the British throne, was spotted smiling as he sat astride a horse, taking a ride on the grounds of Windsor Castle. He was accompanied by an unidentified female rider on her own horse, both wearing helmets, gloves, and coats, and looking to be in good spirits. In a 2022 interview with Vanity Fair, a friend of Andrew's called the public revelation of the royals' ties with Epstein, as well as his bizarre defense, a crescendo of horrors. It just got worse and worse and worse. A 2010 photograph of Andrew and Epstein deep in conversation while walking through New York Central Park was damning enough, but the allegations that later emerged about Epstein and his associates, including that an underage girl had been forced to have sex with Andrew, were much worse. Andrew denied ever having a sexual relationship with her. The Newsnight interview was a bombshell, with Andrew describing Epstein's offenses, the sex crimes he had been convicted of, as well as his own behavior in euphemistic terms, saying that he kicked himself for the events and that he let the side down. Of Epstein, he said, "Do I regret the fact that he has quite obviously conducted himself in a manner unbecoming? Yes." In a statement announcing his resignation from official royal duties a few months after Epstein's 2019 death by apparent suicide in prison, the Duke expressed his remorse, which he had notably not explicitly done in the interview. "I continue to unequivocally regret my ill-judged association with Jeffrey Epstein," he wrote. "His suicide has left many unanswered questions, particularly for his victims, and I deeply sympathize with everyone who has been affected and wants some form of closure. I can only hope that in time they will be able to rebuild their lives. Of course, I am willing to help any appropriate law enforcement agency with their investigations if required." In February 2022, Andrew settled the lawsuit brought against him by Virginia Jeffrey, the woman who accused him of sexually assaulting her. He paid her around $16 million, according to The Telegraph, without admitting wrongdoing. Rufus Sewell, who portrays Andrew in Scoop, told Vanity Fair that the Newsnight interview quotes, such as Andrew explaining away his behavior by describing himself as too honorable, depending on how you view them, are either exasperating or painful to watch, or sometimes, in a dreadful way, kind of funny. Gillian Anderson, who plays journalist Emily Maitlis in the film, avoided watching the interview as long as she could, she said. "I came to it late because I knew that it was going to be cringeworthy," she told Vanity Fair. "For a while, I didn't want to subject myself to that." Though he was stripped of his military titles by the late Queen Elizabeth II, his mother, and forbidden to use his HRH title in an official capacity, Andrew has by no means been banished entirely from the royal family's innermost circles. He attended the high-profile memorial service for Greece's King Constantine in February and joined the family for Easter services last weekend. Continuing in the Hollywood section, Beyoncé is obsessed with giving other artists flowers. This is by Chris Murphy, published on April 4th. Spring flowers may finally be approaching full bloom, but Beyoncé loves to dole them out all year long. Following the debut of her genre-breaking country album, Cowboy Carter Beyoncé is making waves online for her thoughtful habit of sending flower arrangements to some of her favorite artists. In recent weeks, Queen Bey has sent monochromatic, all-white arrangements to everyone from Grammy-winning R&B artist SZA to rock star Jack White to black country artist Mickey Guyton. Alongside the flowers, Beyoncé included a personal note congratulating or thanking the artist for their work. "Mickey, thank you for opening doors for me, Queen. Keep shining," wrote Beyoncé to Guyton, one of the black women in country music, to whom she sent flowers after the release of Cowboy Carter. She thanked White for having inspired her work on Cowboy Carter, the second act of her album trilogy, which began with 2022's house music-inspired renaissance, leading fans to speculate that Act 3 may, in fact, be a rock album. Those lucky enough to receive a flower arrangement from Beyoncé have often expressed their appreciation by posting a photo of it on social media and thanking Queen Bey for her generosity. "Much love and respect to you, madam," wrote White in an Instagram caption accompanying a photo of the bouquet. "Nobody sings like you." R&B artist and former Love and Hip Hop star Kay Michelle, who has dabbled in country music, received a bouquet from Beyoncé and a note that said, "You're killing it." Naturally, Kay Michelle couldn't contain her excitement on social media. "This is so nice. One of the nicest things ever. I'm in tears," she wrote on Instagram. "Thank you for giving me my flowers. They are so beautiful. I'm so nervous about finally getting to put out my first country album, and this just fueled the fire." Of course, a Beyoncé flower arrangement is not just any flower arrangement. Florist La Paris Phillips, owner of the flower shop Brooklyn Blooms, told the New York Times that she believes White's gift cost around $200. The bouquet, Phillips said, looked like it included white ranunculus, white tulips, white agapanthus, white ornithogalum, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, white lisianthus, white stock, and white wax flowers, but not all the arrangements are identical. Manhattan-based florist Stephanie Hopkins told The Times that she believes Guyton's arrangement included spotted anemones and hydrangeas, and maybe even phalaenopsis orchids and white roses. She estimated the price was between $250 and $300. Sending flowers is not a new habit for the Texas Hold'em singer. She's given arrangements to rapper Megan Thee Stallion, Mean Girls Renee Rapp, pop star Katy Perry, Oscar nominee Andra Day, and broadcast journalist Katie Couric. Though Beyoncé has stayed tight-lipped about the method behind her gifts, her legions of fans see the arrangements as embodying Beyoncé's thoughtfulness, generosity, and attention to detail. Classic Virgo traits. Sure, you could buy yourself flowers like Miley Cyrus, Beyoncé's two most wanted duet partner, but if you're lucky, Queen Bey has got you covered. Next up is entitled Breaking the Silence. Quiet on set, filmmakers react to Dan Schneider's apology and tease unanswered questions in new episode. This is by Savannah Walsh, published on April 4th. It's not often that documentarians get stopped in their tracks by adoring fans, but the blockbuster docuseries Quiet on Set, The Dark Side of Kids TV, which exposes abuse and exploitation at the kids' network Nickelodeon, has proved an exception to the rule. Speaking to Vanity Fair, filmmaker Emma Schwartz recalls grabbing a meal with three of the former child actors who participated in the documentary while shooting its latest episode. Two people came up to us at the table and said, "Oh, I just watched the documentary. It was so powerful." And it just showed the magnitude of the impact that you could be sitting in a random pizza joint in New York City and somebody walks up to you about this show. Since premiering on Investigation Discovery and then streaming on Max in mid-March, reactions have poured in from viewers and former child actors alike, including one-time Nickelodeon stars like Kenan Thompson and Melissa Joan Hart, as well as Kirsten Dunst and Jerry O'Connell. "Watching you tonight was one of the bravest things I've seen in my 40 years of this insane business," the latter tweeted to series subject Drake Bell. Upon its debut, the documentary was the number one streaming show across all platforms and has now been seen by more than 20 million people, with the largest audience of any unscripted series since the launch of Max last May, according to ID and Max Discovery Plus. "So many people grew up watching these shows, and that which we watch during our childhood imprints on us in a deep manner," says filmmaker Mary Robertson, who, alongside Schwartz, worked with Business Insider journalist Kate Taylor to build on the investigation into misconduct allegations at Nickelodeon that Taylor published in 2022. In recent years, of course, there were montages of clips from these shows that were swirling around the internet, and there were speculation and some conspiracy, Robertson continued. "It was clear that there was an appetite, a desire to understand what was really happening behind the scenes on the sets that Dan Schneider presided over." Schwartz says that the series' runaway success is also a salient reminder of how much more there is to unearth and explore in this space, both in terms of the questions that have been coming out from smart journalists, as well as former child actors and people in the industry. That continued conversation is explored in an upcoming fifth episode of the series titled Breaking the Silence, which premieres on Sunday, April 7th at 8 p.m., Eastern Time. Soledad O'Brien leads a conversation with All That cast members Giovanni Samuels and Brian Hearn, as well as Hearn's mother, Tracy Brown. The mother and son have repaired a relationship that had been ruptured since the broadcast of the documentary, says Robertson. The episode, which came together in under a month, also features never-before-seen footage, as well as new testimony from former All That cast member Shane Lyons. In the first four episodes, Drake Bell revealed the sexual abuse he endured at the hands of former Nickelodeon vocal coach Brian Peck, who in October 2004 was convicted on sexual abuse charges, sentenced to 16 months in prison, and ordered to register as a sex offender. Bell reemerges in the next episode to update viewers on what life has been like since his emotional disclosure. "We're in touch all the time, just checking in, seeing how he's doing," says Schwartz. "It's been a long journey to this point to share something that you've kept secret for 20 years, and then experiencing that hitting the public. I think he's definitely felt like a weight has been lifted." Quiet on Set doesn't shirk away from Bell's own legal case involving a minor. Bell pleaded guilty to attempted child endangerment in 2021 after exchanging inappropriate text messages with an underage fan. He was sentenced to 2 years probation and 200 hours of community service. The filmmakers were committed to acknowledging the controversy while also creating space for Bell to tell his own story of abuse. A lot of our focus is really in understanding the experience of child actors on the sets during this era at Nickelodeon, whether it was Drake, Amanda Bynes, Katrina Johnson, Giovanni, everyone, Schwartz explains. And clearly the experiences that people have had as child actors had a long shadow in terms of how it affected their life. Elsewhere in the new episode, Bell confronts those who wrote letters of support for his abuser in regards to his sentencing from Boy Meets World cast members Ryder Strong and Will Friedle, who declined to participate in the docuseries but apologized on their podcast for supporting Peck, to those who've remained silent on the subject like Taryn Killam and James Marsden. When it comes to the letters of support, we continue to have a lot of questions about the circumstances under which they were written, says Schwartz. The follow-up allowed the filmmakers an opportunity to examine other facets of the documentary's aftermath, including an apology video that former Nickelodeon mega producer Dan Schneider released regarding some of the allegations of racism and sexism against him. In a statement, Schneider previously told Vanity Fair that he would absolutely do some things differently. "I've learned a lot over the years about how to be a better boss." Both Robertson and Schwartz have seen Schneider's remarks. "We reached out to him in the process of creating our project. We offered him a chance to sit for an interview, which he declined, and had sent him some written questions," says Schwartz. "It certainly speaks to the power of the project when people respond to it. For some of our participants, it impacted them heavily. They speak to that in the upcoming episode, as well as the current state of their relationships with Dan." Days after the series premiered, actors from Nickelodeon's Ned Declassified School Survival Guide appeared to be making light of some of the doc's more devastating allegations on social media, something for which they've since apologized. "When something is as popular as Quiet on Set is, there's bound to be some negative reactions," says Robertson, "but we've been overwhelmed by the extent of the positive impact that the film has had on the people who participated." The series has even emboldened some former child performers, including Zoe 101's Matthew Underwood, to come forward about abuse they faced in their adolescence. "It's obviously really disturbing to hear further traumatic accounts, but it's also heartening to feel that people feel safe in starting to share their stories," says Schwartz. "I can say with certainty there's definitely a lot of other people who are processing what they went through." While the series may have created a haven for some to detail their traumatic experiences, it has also led to problematic social media demand for ex-Nickelodeon stars like Ariana Grande and Josh Peck to address the allegations. "One thing we've learned from people who have been in the public eye is that even if they're not saying something publicly right now, it doesn't mean they're not processing," says Robertson. Adds ID executive Jason Sarlanis, "One of the key things of our series is about giving survivors agency and empowering them to use their voice when and how they're ready to do it." And the Quiet on Set team is committed to telling those stories as they materialize. "We would love to continue this line of reporting and investigation," says Robertson. "Clearly, there are so many unanswered questions and a passion for these stories, and we absolutely want to be the home for them going forward." This could mean making additional installments of the original docuseries or another project entirely, says Sarlanis. "It's really more about the mission than the specific episode count or title that takes. As long as people directly impacted by this part of pop culture history want a platform, we're committed to find ways to do that." Nickelodeon previously said in a statement to Vanity Fair that it investigates all complaints as part of our commitment to fostering a safe and professional workplace and has adopted numerous safeguards over the years. But the Quiet on Set team is glad the documentary has opened up a space to discuss industry-wide reform for child actors, including requiring background checks of those working where children are present, mental health resources on set, and even federal legislation concerning the safety of young performers who have now infiltrated YouTube and TikTok. I hope our documentary serves as a cautionary tale for future emerging platforms that utilize children in this space of entertainment, many in the social digital sphere that have zero regulation or oversight, says Sarlanis. Our documentary, I believe, sparked a movement, he tells Vanity Fair. I was speaking to the team member of a former child star, who I won't name, but they said that their reaction to this was just the word, finally. Now to the Disney boardroom, Bob Iger thinks, quote, woke Disney critics don't even know what woke means. This is by Chris Murphy, published on April 4th. Bob Iger has a message for those criticizing Disney for being too woke. The Disney CEO sat for an interview at Disney HQ on Thursday and directly addressed high-profile critics, including Elon Musk and Nelson Peltz, about the direction in which he's steering the entertainment behemoth. In the interview with CNBC reporter David Faber, Iger mentioned that Disney is not primarily concerned with infusing messaging into its programming and that it remains an entertainment-first company. Musk has taken it upon himself to wage a war against Iger's vision of Disney. The ex-CEO has repeatedly called out Iger and Disney for being too woke, posting on April Fool's Day that he was joining the company as its chief DEI officer. Can't wait to work with Bob Iger and Kathleen Kennedy to make their content more woke, the mogul wrote. Even the linguini. This apparently was Musk's attempt at a funny joke. Iger certainly wasn't laughing. I ignore it, Iger told Faber of Musk's pestering. There's no relevance to the Walt Disney Company or to me. While he's not concerned with Musk's comedic stylings, Iger did indirectly address Musk's notion that Disney has been going woke, promising that the company's focus is on entertainment rather than moralizing. Infusing messaging as the sort of number one priority in our films and TV shows is not what we're up to. They need to be entertaining, said Iger. And look, where the Disney Company can have a positive impact on the world, whether it's fostering acceptance and understanding of people of all different types, great. But generally speaking, we need to be an entertainment-first company, and I've worked really hard to do that. Musk is not the only billionaire taking shots at Iger. Peltz, who runs the multi-billion dollar hedge fund Trian Partners, recently lost a proxy war for control of the Disney board, with the firm spending about $25 million in its failed attempt to oust Iger, according to the New York Times. Disney reportedly spent as much as $40 million in its successful counter campaign. Musk pledged his support for Peltz on X, posting on April 3rd that Nelson Peltz should definitely be on the Disney board and that the 81-year-old would help reform the company and significantly improve Disney's share price. As for Peltz, Iger called their proxy war distracting and maintained that it was absolutely not helpful for the company. Despite the protestations of Musk and Peltz, he claimed that the noise pertaining to Disney and its purported woke pivot has sort of quieted down and maintained that the word itself is starting to lose meaning, becoming a catch-all for his detractors. The term woke is thrown around rather liberally, Iger said. I think a lot of people don't really understand what it means. Musk certainly doesn't. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are currently reading from vanityfair.com. We just finished an article on Disney, and it's going to propel us into the politics section. Our first politics article comes from the magazine, the April issue. Inside the Terrifyingly Competent Trump 2024 Campaign. This is by Gabriel Sherman, published on the 4th. On the evening of August 24th, Donald Trump's motorcade passed through downtown Atlanta toward the Fulton County Jail. Scores of people lined the streets, snapping photos. News helicopters buzzed overhead. Not since police chased O.J. Simpson's white Bronco down a Los Angeles freeway had a vehicle's movement so breathlessly covered by the media. Trump was en route to be arrested on 13 felony counts, alleging he conspired to steal the 2020 election in Georgia. He would become the first former president in United States history to have his mugshot taken. Inside his SUV, Trump didn't seem alarmed by his legal peril. A campaign advisor later recalled that Trump was focused on looking defiant. He was determined not to have a bad mugshot, the advisor said. Trump understood the photograph would become a defining image of the 2024 campaign. To Democrats and the fraction of Republicans horrified by the idea of a second Trump administration, it symbolized its dangerous criminality. For MAGA and the majority of GOP voters, it would be visual proof of Trump's persecution by the deep state. After having his fingerprints taken, Trump turned to the camera, doing his best Clint Eastwood circa Gran Torino. You half expected him to snarl, "Get off my lawn." But even Trump underestimated the image's value. "Can you believe this?" he marveled on the flight back to Palm Beach when advisors told him people were already selling merchandise online. Trump ordered his campaign to get in on the action. Later that night, Trump tweeted the image and a link to his website. "Mugshot, August 24th, 2023, election interference, never surrender." Within 2 days, the campaign announced it had raised more than $7 million. For decades, Trump has monetized chaos and conflict. His multiple divorces, bankruptcies, and lawsuits played as plot lines in a serialized tabloid spectacle. But Trump's 2024 presidential campaign represents a sinister evolution of his brand. He is running as a would-be dictator out for revenge. "I am your retribution," he told supporters at the Conservative Political Action Conference in March 2023. In September, Trump accused then-Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley of treason when it was reported Milley privately assured the Chinese military during the January 6 Capitol riot that the American government remained stable. "This is an act so egregious that in times gone by, the punishment would have been death," Trump wrote on Truth Social. At rallies, Trump even invoked the dehumanizing language of Nazis. "We will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country," Trump told supporters in New Hampshire last November. If Trump wins back the White House, his increasingly extreme and violent rhetoric is poised to become policy. The New York Times reported Trump plans to order mass roundups of undocumented immigrants and detain them in deportation camps. Trump has promised to direct the Justice Department to prosecute Joe Biden. At a rally in February, Trump said that he would encourage Russia to do whatever the hell they want to any NATO country that doesn't increase military spending. Veterans of Trump's first administration are sounding the alarm. "He is the domestic terrorist of the 21st century," former communications director Anthony Scaramucci has said. Former Attorney General Bill Barr testified to the January 6 committee that Trump was detached from reality. This sort of deep-seated impulse to demolish boundaries long predates even Trump's first run for presidency. While reporting this article, I heard a story Chris Christie has told people about Trump's inherent lawlessness. In the summer of 2009, Trump told people how furious he was that his daughter Ivanka got engaged to Jared Kushner and agreed to convert to Judaism. "You're not going to believe this. My daughter's going to be a Jew," Trump said, according to a person who heard the remarks. According to a source, Trump told Christie, who was the former U.S. attorney in New Jersey, to help him stop the marriage. Trump invited Christie to dinner at 21 Club in Manhattan and asked for FBI dirt on Kushner's father, Charles. 5 years earlier, Christie had negotiated a guilty plea from Charles, a billionaire real estate developer, for 16 counts of assisting in the filing of false tax returns, one count of retaliating against a cooperating witness, and one count of making false statements to the Federal Election Commission. Trump told Christie he wanted to show the dirt to Ivanka to convince her to break up with Kushner. "She can't marry this kid. He's a twerp," Trump said. Christie told Trump that sharing confidential grand jury evidence is a crime and didn't do it. The Trump campaign did not reply to a request for comment. Christie declined to comment. But here's where a second Trump administration might really distinguish itself. While his 2016 agenda was frequently stymied by infighting and incompetence, available signs point to a second West Wing staffed by loyalists who would actually carry out his policies. The takeover of the Republican National Committee, which Trump recently completed, installing his daughter-in-law Lara as co-chair, is a blueprint to keep in mind. President Trump knows who can deliver and who can't. The backstabbers who were around the 2016 won't be in this next White House, Trump's senior campaign advisor Jason Miller told me. Trump's 2024 campaign has already demonstrated Trump can run an effective operation. This campaign is locked down, a Republican close to Trump said. In previous cycles, Trump populated his campaigns with huge egos like Roger Stone, Kushner, Ivanka, Steve Bannon, Kellyanne Conway, Corey Lewandowski, and Brad Parscale, among others. In 2024, Trump's inner circle is made up of heads-down operatives Susie Wiles, Chris LaCivita, Miller, and James Blair, who don't play their agendas through social media. "You have experienced people who don't leak," longtime Trump confidant Stone said. Trump trusts his senior team to do their jobs. In the past, Trump worked the phone constantly, soliciting advice from a wide circle of friends, family, Manhattan business associates, and media personalities. Trump's style of pitting staffers against one another created an incentive to leak. The side whose opinion lost would run to the media, a 2020 campaign veteran explained. This time, he's not talking to randos. Most of all, Trump is disciplined because fear is a powerful motivator. His wealth and freedom are at stake. In February, a Manhattan Supreme Court judge ordered Trump to pay $454 million after he found Trump guilty of fraudulently inflating his net worth to obtain favorable loans. That same month, a jury ordered Trump to pay $83 million in a defamation lawsuit brought by writer E. Jean Carroll, who claimed Trump raped her in a department store dressing room in the mid-1990s. The jury found Trump liable for sexual abuse, and Trump continues to deny all of the charges against him. In a March, an appeals court drastically reduced the bond requirement in the fraud case. In all, Trump faces 88 felony counts across four criminal cases, the outcome of which could send him to jail for the rest of his life. He has pleaded not guilty to all charges in all cases. "He's terrified of going to jail," a longtime friend from New York told me. Trump's best chance at protecting his freedom is to win the presidency. Trump's dominance in the 2024 Republican field made the primary seem like his coronation. So it might be hard to remember that 18 months ago, eons in political time, Trump was exiled at Mar-a-Lago, a twice-impeached loser hawking NFTs. Reporters wrote pieces calling the ex-president's grim, old, tired, lonely, defeated. A former Trump official told me at the time that the ex-president was in a weird bunker and didn't want to go anywhere. November 22 was a particularly brutal month. Many Trump-endorsed candidates were wiped out in the midterms. A week later, Trump launched his 2024 campaign with a low-energy speech that even Ivanka skipped. She released a statement announcing she didn't want to be part of the campaign. Meanwhile, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis won re-election by a crushing 19 points. Billionaire Republican donors like Ken Griffin and Steven Schwarzman declared that they would support the 44-year-old governor over Trump. Rupert Murdoch's New York Post splashed DeSantis on the cover with the headline, "De Future." Trump's self-destructive spiral accelerated. 2 days before Thanksgiving that year, he hosted a dinner at Mar-a-Lago with Nick Fuentes and Ye, the rapper formerly known as Kanye West. Trump's choice of guests was the stuff of political suicide. Balenciaga, Gap, and Adidas had then cut business ties with Ye over his tweeted threat to go DEFCON 3 on Jewish people. Fuentes attended both the neo-Nazi march in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the January 6 Capitol riot. His hateful history included statements like, "Total Aryan victory, that's what I want." Early the next month, Trump wrote on Truth Social that he wanted to terminate the Constitution. Republicans denounced the idea en masse. The grip of his personality cult seemed to be finally loosening. A USA Today Suffolk University poll found that DeSantis beat Trump 56% to 33% in a head-to-head contest. Inside Trump's tight inner circle, it was time to stage an intervention. He heard from people he cares about that he was screwing up, the campaign advisor said. Trump claimed he hadn't heard about Ye's anti-Semitic controversy and didn't even know who Fuentes was. Friends and advisors argued that it didn't matter. A presidential candidate needed to screen who he associated with. After that, he did get religion, the advisor said. The campaign empowered body man Walt Nauta to act as gatekeeper. Trump had grown especially close with Nauta, a 41-year-old former Navy cook who served as Trump's White House valet. Nada has been indicted along with Trump in the Florida federal case and has pleaded not guilty. If the president's tie ever gets even a drop of water, Walt exchanges it for a new one. I don't think King Charles has anyone this good, the campaign advisor said. Nada was part of a new cadre of loyal aides staffing the 2024 campaign. It is a professionalized operation focused on one thing, winning. In early February 2023, Miller, the CEO of right-wing social media platform Getter, joined the campaign as senior strategist and messaging guru. With Miller and spokesperson Stephen Chung driving the message, the campaign started to change the news cycle. Trump visited the town of East Palestine, Ohio, weeks after a train derailment caused a disastrous chemical fire. Cameras captured Trump handing out bottles of Trump spring water and McDonald's hamburgers to the community. In a well-covered speech, Trump blasted the Biden White House for not sending enough aid. That was a turning point, the campaign advisor said. But no one represented Trump's drama-free campaign more than Chris LaCivita. In October 2022, the 56-year-old Marine veteran, who has a shaved head and a linebacker build, joined the campaign as senior advisor. LaCivita is a practitioner of the political dark arts. During the 2004 presidential election, he advised the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth group that smeared John Kerry's Vietnam War record. It was a supreme act of chutzpah. Kerry's opponent, George W. Bush, never served in Vietnam. LaCivita is more than a street brawler. He has a Talmudic understanding of primary rules. Last summer, LaCivita lobbied state Republican parties to change their process to favor Trump. For example, he convinced the California GOP to apportion all delegates to the winner. While everyone was dicking around last year, the Trump people were changing all these party rules, getting their people in place, changing the battlefield, a top GOP strategist said. Trump benefited from a GOP primary crowded with inept candidates. His closest challengers, DeSantis and Nikki Haley, spent months attacking one another instead of rallying around a single candidate with the best chance of beating Trump one-on-one. But Trump's political resurgence was also powered by the most unlikely fuel, his criminal indictments. In December 2022, about 60% of Republicans wanted to nominate someone other than Trump, according to CNN's survey. In March 2023, Trump's numbers shot up after the Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg indicted himself for falsifying business records to hide the hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels. Trump denies that the affair took place. Weeks after the New York indictment, Trump led his closest challenger, DeSantis, by 35 points, according to 538. Later that summer, Trump was indicted in three more jurisdictions. In Florida federal court for allegedly hiding classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, and for obstruction in the retrieval of the documents. In Washington, D.C., federal court for allegedly preventing the peaceful transfer of power in 2020, and in Georgia state court for trying to overturn Biden's victory in 2020. By September 23, Trump led DeSantis by 45 points. The criminal charges helped solve Trump's messaging problem. Prior to the indictments, Trump was a one-line artist singing a tired tune that the 2020 election was stolen. But the dozens of felony counts gave him new material. He cast himself as a political martyr being prosecuted by the Biden White House. And there was the added benefit that his defense lawyers took up a large part of his schedule, leaving less time to stoke new controversies. He's so distracted with the legal stuff, that's why the campaign is smooth, a Republican close to Trump said. On March 2nd, the New York Times published a poll that sent waves of panic crashing through the Democratic Party. It showed Trump beating Biden by 5 points in a head-to-head contest. With Trump ahead as the general election kicked off, speculation naturally turned to a Trump second-term agenda. In politics, they say policy is personnel, and this is especially true in Trump world. Trump values relationships and his family more than someone's position in a West Wing org chart. To understand what Trump 2.0 might accomplish, you have to look at who in the MAGAverse is angling to populate his administration. There's a total jockeying operation, a former White House official said. It's a clearly defined formula. Go on TV and say nice things about Trump and beat up his enemies. He's following very closely. So far, the horse race to be Trump's running mate has gotten the lion's share of attention. Names being floated included Senator J.D. Vance, Senator Tim Scott, Ben Carson, Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, Governor Kristi Noem, and former Fox News host Tucker Carlson. One campaign staffer told me Carson is ascendant. Carson, the retired neurosurgeon and former Trump cabinet official, has been loyal to Trump since 2016. The campaign's view is that he could motivate black voters to break with Biden. The recent Times poll showed Trump support from black voters jumped to 23% from 4% in 2020. Multiple sources I spoke to stressed that Trump's number one staffing criteria is loyalty. It's widely assumed that Trump's campaign advisors would occupy major West Wing roles, but the executive branch is a vast apparatus. According to sources, Trump has set up a vetting operation run by John McEntee, his first-term dictator of the White House Presidential Personnel Office. McEntee is HR. He is so close to the president, a campaign staffer told me. Last May, McEntee joined the right-wing Heritage Foundation's 2025 Presidential Transition Project. According to Heritage's website, the initiative will vet thousands of potential applicants in advance of January 20th, 2025, when the next president takes office. Trump needs a long list because he's vowed to purge 50,000 civil servants and stock federal agencies with political appointees. According to the Brookings Institution, Trump's plan would be the most fundamental change to the civil service system since its inception in 1883. Inside the Trump campaign, McEntee is well-liked and feared. Johnny has a lot more access to Trump than anybody else does, the campaign staffer said. Paranoia about leaks ratcheted up in November when the Times published a shocking piece detailing Trump's plans to build detention camps for undocumented migrants. There was a lot of examination about whose fingerprints were on that article, the source said. Trump's most consequential appointment would be his attorney general. The country's top law enforcement official will have the power to throw out the federal charges against Trump and prosecute his enemies. One name being floated is Kash Patel, who served as chief of staff in the Department of Defense. Patel has made incendiary threats. "We will go out and find the conspirators not just in governments but in the media," Patel said on Steve Bannon's War Room podcast last year. "We're going to come after you whether it's criminally or civilly." For immigration policy, sources said Trump likes Thomas Homan, the former acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to be Homeland Security director. Homan was the architect of Trump's family separation policy at the southern border and remains unapologetic about the program that resulted in 4,000 children being taken from their parents. "I'm sick and tired of hearing about family separation. Bottom line is we enforce the law," Homan said at CPAC last year. Stephen Miller is also likely to return in an immigration policy role. A former White House official speculated that Miller could be immigration/deportation czar because he'd be too controversial for a Senate-confirmed position. Trump prefers Miller to be behind the scenes. "Trump thinks he turns people off. He's terrible on TV," a Republican close to Trump said. At the State Department, sources said Richard Grenell, Trump's former ambassador to Germany, is making an aggressive play for the job. But sources say Kushner could return to Washington in the role. One source briefed on the conversation said Republican senators have privately asked Kushner to head the agency. According to the source, Kushner said he would wait until late summer to consider serving as the nation's top diplomat. So how extreme could a second Trump administration get? One thing is certain, few of the guardrails that protected American democracy during his first term are still standing. In February, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Trump's last GOP antagonist, announced he would be stepping down and soon endorsed Trump. "Trump wants to disintegrate the administrative state," Scaramucci told me. "They want to wipe out the separation of powers and make Trump a dictator. It's very clear." Whether through enhanced discipline or legal circumstance, it appears ever more likely that a second Trump administration would be better primed to achieve its goals. As John Kelly, Trump's longest-serving chief of staff, simply warned, "God help us." God help us indeed. That was a longer article than expected, so we're turning to the Best Levin section of our time. First headline, Democrats see the GOP bill to rename airport after Trump, raise them one to name a federal prison after him instead. Neither bill is likely to pass. This is published on April 5th. Earlier this week, a group of House Republicans unveiled a bill to rename Washington Dulles International Airport after Donald Trump. Freedom, prosperity, strength, that's what America stood for under the leadership of President Donald J. Trump, the best president of my lifetime, bill sponsor Guy Reichenthaler wrote in a post on X. And that's why I'm introducing legislation to rename Dulles as the Donald J. Trump International Airport. Not surprisingly, Democrats panned the idea, calling it ridiculous and saying no sane person would support it. And now they've offered a counterproposal they believe would be more fitting, to rename a federal prison after the ex-president instead. On Friday, Representatives Jerry Connolly, Jared Moskowitz, and John Geramendi unveiled a bill to rename the Miami Federal Correctional Institution in Florida the Donald J. Trump Federal Correctional Institution. In a statement, Connolly said, "When our Republican colleagues introduced their bill to rename Dulles after Donald Trump, I said the more fitting option would be to rename a federal prison. I hope our Republican friends will join us in bestowing upon Donald J. Trump the only honor he truly deserves." Noting that Trump loves to write his name in gold letters on all of his buildings, Moskowitz said, "He's never had his name on a federal building before, and as a public servant, I just want to help the former president. Help us make that dream a reality," Geramendi echoed. "Donald J. Trump is the first former president in history to be criminally indicted, with 88 offenses in 4 criminal cases to date. I cannot think of a more fitting tribute to our former president, Donald J. Trump, than renaming the closest federal prison to Mar-a-Lago in his honor." In Florida, Trump faces charges of alleged willful retention of national defense information and obstructing justice, among other things. The judge in the federal case has yet to set a trial date, but should one actually happen, and should Trump be convicted, the ex-president faces up to 10 years in prison. He has pleaded not guilty to those charges and all other charges against him. In another federal case, Trump has been indicted for trying to overturn the 2020 election. On the state level, he was charged in Georgia with trying to overturn the election that in that state, and also faces charges in New York for allegedly falsifying business records related to his Stormy Daniels hush money payment. The latter case, brought by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, is scheduled to start late this month. Our next headline, Trump sues the Truth Social co-founders who made him billions in the Trumpiest lawsuit of all time. This is published on the 3rd. Truth Social was created as a result of Donald Trump being kicked off of Twitter for inciting a violent riot and using the platform to claim it was justified. Now, 2 years after launching, the ex-president's social network continues to be a hotbed of chaos and drama, with Trump most recently suing the parent company's own co-founders. Yes, just days before Trump Media and Technology Group was listed on the NASDAQ, the ex-president filed a lawsuit against Trump Media executives Wes Moss and Andy Litinsky, claiming the duo failed to properly debut Truth Social, find a merger partner to take the company public, and set up a corporate governance structure for the parent company. For their alleged offenses, Trump wants Moss and Litinsky, Apprentice alums, to be stripped of their 8.6% stake in the company, currently valued at around $606 million. The suit follows a February filing against Trump from the two men in which they claimed the former president tried to dilute their shares by increasing the total number of shares in the company from 120 million to 1 billion. At a hearing in Delaware on Monday, the executives told Judge Sam Glasok III that they will request an order barring Trump's suit against them until their claims are resolved. According to Bloomberg, Glasok said he was gobsmacked to find out about Trump's lawsuit. While Trump's personal stake in the company has fallen in value since last week's debut, following the disclosure that it had just $4.1 million in revenue last year and around $58 million in losses, it is still worth billions. Commenting on Trump's attempt to strip the very people who set him up to receive such a big financial windfall, Joe Scarborough called it the Trumpiest story of all time. He added, "So this guy starts a company, goes public, everything Trump does, you know, he loses billions of dollars, it seems, and then he sues his co-founders. This is literally everything he does, his whole life. He gets a painter to paint his office, they'll paint it, he'll sue them and say, I'll give you 50%. It's so sleazy, but it's how you and I and Morning Joe co-host Mika and everybody else that's been around him for decades, they all say that's how he works. Everybody that goes into business with this guy regrets it because he's a terrible businessman and he sues you." Trump has long been accused of stiffing the people who work for him. In other Truth Social news, The Guardian reported on Wednesday that Trump Media managed to go public last week only after it had been kept afloat in 2020 by emergency loans provided in part by a Russian-American businessman under scrutiny in a federal insider trading and money laundering investigation. In a statement, a lawyer for Trump Media told the outlet, The Guardian continues to propagate its false narratives that TMTG has these fake connections to Russia. It is a hoax. Litigation will continue on this point, and we are confident that The Guardian will ultimately be held responsible for its defamation, and this story should be retracted. Also on Wednesday, two Florida venture capitalists pleaded guilty to insider trading based on material, non-public information that special purpose acquisition company Digital World Acquisition Corporation was going to buy Trump Media. And our last headline has a little Arizona connection. Arizona Republicans vote yes for a bill that would make it legal to kill migrants suspected of trespassing. This is published on the 1st. How do Arizona Republicans think the border crisis should be solved? By giving people the legal right to shoot and kill undocumented immigrants via legislation that critics say will give the green light to more extrajudicial killings. House Republicans in the border state are advancing HB 2843, which declares a person may use deadly physical force if they believe it immediately necessary to stop someone from trespassing or attempting to trespass on their property. While the bill does not include the word immigrants or migrants, as Axios notes, Representative Justin Heap, who sponsored the legislation, said in February that its intended purpose is to close a loophole that he contends has led to increasingly larger numbers of migrants or human traffickers moving across farm and ranch land. Currently, state law, the Castle Doctrine, allows deadly force to be used against home intruders for self-defense. Criminal defense attorney Jack Litwack told the Arizona Mirror, the new law would give people much more cover, as it will allow the use of deadly force merely for appearing on one's property. The idea with the Castle Doctrine is that you're supposed to be able to defend house and home, he said. This seems to broaden it to say you can shoot somebody that's just on your actual property. Arguing against HB 2843 last month, Democratic Representative Annalise Ortiz said the legislation expands the Castle Doctrine law in a way that I think is very dangerous, as guns continue to wreak havoc upon our communities. I do not think there is any sense in giving a green light to more extrajudicial killings. The bill was approved in the State House by a 31-28 vote. Next, it heads to the Senate. If passed there, it's expected to be vetoed by Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs. Arizona rancher George Allen Kelly is currently on trial on charges of second-degree murder and aggravated assault for allegedly killing Gabriel Quen Butamea after shooting at a group of unarmed migrants crossing his ranch. As the AZ Mirror notes, under the proposed law, Kelly could have been justified for allegedly killing any of the migrants. The outlet also notes that a 2022 JAMA Network study showed that stand-your-ground laws were linked to an 8-11% increase in monthly rates of homicide and firearm homicide, leading researchers to conclude that the enactment of similar legislation across the country was directly related to an increase in violent and avoidable deaths. This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thanks so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week. We'll have another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. We'll check in on Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce, see what the Royals are up to, and of course, hear what Bess Levin is writing about. Thank you so much, and have a great week, everybody.